Morning, Governor.
Good morning. Welcome to the Board of Public Works. Before we begin, I just want to take a moment. Today marks the one-year anniversary since the tragic shooting at Great Mills High School in St. Mary's County. I remember it like it was yesterday, rushing down there immediately after the incident, and then attending the memorial service for Jalen Willie, meeting with Great Mills students in my office after the tragedy, and then having a ceremony honoring the heroic school resource officer, Deputy First Class Blaine Gaskill, for his bravery in stopping a further loss of life. And in the wake of that tragedy, we immediately proposed the most aggressive school safety proposals in the country. All of us, we all continue to pray for Jalen, the young girl that was killed in that senseless act of violence. Our prayers continue to be with her family and loved ones and with all of the students and faculty and staff and for really the entire Great Mills community. So at this time, I'd just like to ask everyone to please join me in a moment of silence for Great Mills and to honor the life and the memory of Jalen Willie. Thank you. On a more cheerful note on the first day of spring, we have a special guest joining us this morning that I'm very excited about. Captain Ed O'Brien is a man that I have had the pleasure of getting to know. Captain Ed has committed his time and talents to improving the management of our natural resources and preserving the state's fishing heritage and the charter boat industry. Ed has been a charter boat captain for more than 40 years, entertaining celebrities and politicians and even presidents, while displaying the beauty of our greatest natural treasure, the Chesapeake Bay. He's been appointed by four governors over a span of 30 years to the Sport Fisheries Advisory Commission. Ed advises the Department of Natural Resources on fisheries issues. He's a founding board member of the Maryland Sportsman's Foundation, and he served as president of the Charter Boat Association, vice president of the National Association of Charter Boat Operators, and he received the Meritorious Public Service Award from the U.S. Coast Guard. Today, we're pleased to present Captain Ed O'Brien with a very special tribute as we bestow upon him our highest honor, the Admiral of the Chesapeake Lifetime Award. So let's give him a big round of applause.
You and your family can come back here for a picture.
Side, since we have so many folks that want to get in the picture with you, just come on through. It's a big crew. Oh, we're gonna have to use the. Maybe some of you can go on this side so we can squeeze all together. Got the entire crew here with you. Come on, you're gonna get in between all of us, and then we'll have everybody try to. Let's all pretend like we really like each other and squeeze in as much as we can.
Ed, you gotta stand here
next to me so we can give you this.
And
got a lot of people pretty proud of you, I think, Ed.
Well, it makes me feel good. You make me feel good.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, right up here.
Were you able to get everybody?
Yeah.
Congratulations. One more time.
Could you stay for 1 second?
I have given these comptroller medallions to governors and ambassadors, VIPs, muckamucks, but never had a chance to give one to an admiral. So,
thank you. Hey, thank you very much. Congratulations on this.
Captain Ed said, that's a lot for a Marine sergeant. We just promoted him to admiral. Well, thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues for any opening comments. Mr. Comptroller. Madam Treasurer.
Governor, first of all, I echo the praise of the admiral. Mm-hmm. I actually have been out with that. He's a great ambassador for the Bay and for our state. Just to take a moment to recognize another great Marylander, Harry Hughes, with whom some of us served. It seems like only yesterday, but it was a little while ago. Harry passed away last week, after a relatively brief illness. He was a great governor. I had the honor to serve when Harry was Secretary of Transportation, the first Secretary of Transportation, and the one who formed Maryland's modern Department of Transportation, its unique system with a transportation trust fund and everybody working together. He had a capacity, whether it was in the Senate or as Secretary or as governor, and afterwards, to bring everybody together. A quiet but determined person. He was always a surprise at the end of the session because people always thought Harry was quiet and not pushy, and yet he got what he needed done. He got what he wanted done, and there were some great things. Whether it was protecting the Bay or advancing civil rights, supporting education, helping create the first modern education funding formula. Harry's hands were on all of that. And while he wasn't expected to become governor, I think that most thinking Marylanders will agree that he was a great governor and a good man. And that combination is something that stands, I think, as the Maryland model. You've mentioned the Maryland model. You can be a strong politician. You can have an agenda that will take pushing and take working and take bringing people together, but you can accomplish it. And Harry did that. And we will all miss him. I almost left the legislature to join his administration. I'm glad I stayed where I was, but he was a very, very persuasive, strong, and good man.
Thank you very much for mentioning Governor Hughes. He was an incredible governor, and I was lucky enough to have gotten to know him and to consider him a good friend and a mentor. I'm honored they've asked me to give a eulogy for him tomorrow. The kind of humble, unassuming guy that he always was. He did not want to lie in state in the state house like most previous governors do. We wanted to honor him, but he wanted it more low key. But we are going to have a reception at the Governor's Mansion after the service, the funeral tomorrow, which is an incredible guy. And I got the chance to go over and visit him at his home in Denton not too long before he passed. And I can tell you I learned a heck of a lot from Harry Hughes. And one thing we shared in common, we were the governors nobody expected to be elected. Came, you know, surprised a lot of folks. But he really was a gentleman who did a lot for the state, and he'll never be forgotten. He'll be missed. And tomorrow we're going to give him the best send-off we can, but a modest one, which is what he always wanted. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Comptroller. Delighted to hear those words from the governor and the treasurer. And I got to visit Governor Hughes on February 28th and told me that he was going to be buried in his backyard right on the Choptank River. Beautiful spot. Right next to his beloved wife, Pat. I, of course, said, "Is that legal?" He said, "Down here, nobody asks." It's just, so, Governor and Madam Treasurer, thank you for those words. I think they're entirely appropriate. Governor Hughes was a statesman and a consummate public servant who followed his moral compass over the course of his distinguished career in public service. He entered the political arena to make a difference in the lives of others. And you mentioned that he was an accidental governor. I don't happen to think he was accidental, and I don't think you're accidental either. I, however, was described as a lost ball in high grass when I was running for comptroller, so I enjoy that comparison to Governor Hughes at one point, I think, in the press. But he was, in innumerable ways, a reformer. Someone who despised the corruption and the backroom deals that had engulfed state politics back in his day. And through his modest, principled way of governing, restored the people's faith in the institutions of power here in Annapolis. I was grateful for the opportunity to sit with him a little bit. He was, as I described, completely at ease and totally irreverent. And humble is the right word to describe him. It's that humbleness that comes from being part of an older generation, I think. He talked a lot about my legendary predecessor, Comptroller Louis Goldstein. I wasn't always completely complimentary, but that's okay. And he talked about the current events, talked about the future of the state. And benefited, as the governor said, from my chat with Governor Hughes, and I will carry with me the words of wisdom that he generously imparted to me over the years. Maryland lost one of our finest public servants last week, and I, like so many others out there, mourn the passing of a friend to the state. And I see his portrait directly across from us, and I think that captures his spirit of informality, openness, transparency, accountability, and competence, which is how I view Governor Hughes. Thank you, Governor.
Could I take one more moment to mention something about Harry Hughes that I don't think many people remember, but during his second term, Harry thought it would be a good thing to create a Maryland Center on essentially civil rights and civil liberties, and to be another venue for bringing people together. And in fact, went so far as to create it and to choose some leadership, board leadership. It was a time when, again, we were talking about diversity, and diversity was under attack. And you needed a place to bring people together. Interestingly, the two people who took the lead were Birch Bayh, former Senator Birch Bayh, who also passed away this week, and the late, great Juanita Jackson Mitchell. And they brought together a group. Unfortunately, bad times hit, and it I think, did not succeed. I must admit, I applied to be the executive director of that group. And meeting those people and meeting them with Governor Hughes and hearing Governor Hughes again and Birch Bayh and Mrs. Mitchell talk about the importance of bringing people together, the importance of taking a stand, I think was rather transforming. I really regret that it didn't become the institution that Harry dreamed of, but another great example of the sort of dream that he dreamed.
Senator Bai lived on the Eastern Shore, Easton.
Yeah.
In fact, I see my chief of staff sitting here. I'm not quite sure why he's here, but that's,
he's just keeping an eye on you.
He's watching.
Watching to make sure you don't mess up. Governor Hughes was a terrific governor. He was way ahead of his time on civil rights, on appointing women and minorities to positions in state government. He was way ahead of his time on the protection of the Chesapeake Bay, getting federal assistance and working together with our surrounding states. And he became governor after a turbulent time, at a time when the state really needed him. And he was exactly the kind of leadership we needed at the time he was there. So, thank you. Let's get started with the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 9 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have 3 reports of emergency procurements. We are prepared for any questions you might have.
Item A3.
Item A3 is an emergency report from the Division of Rehabilitation Services. Is Mr. Sherd here? Byrne. Or whomever. Come up and introduce yourself for the record. And
good morning.
Board's got questions.
For the record, I'm Emily Brandenburg, Deputy for Finance and Administration. With me today is Scott Dennis, the Assistant State Superintendent for the Division of Rehabilitation Services.
Good morning. I'm Scott Dennis, Assistant State Superintendent. Be happy to answer any questions.
Great. I understand that the department terminated the original contract for performance, which is, I guess, why we're here today. But I'm a little bit confused about why this item is before us as an emergency procurement, an emergency contract. You know, we've been very clear about the kinds of things that we want to come before the board as an emergency versus a non-emergency. An emergency is when it's life-threatening or presenting an immediate danger, or if we have pipes burst in a building that need to be immediately repaired, but Snickers bars and sodas at rest stops doesn't seem to me to be an emergency that needs to come before this body in this kind of a way. Can you explain that to me?
I'd be happy to, sir. The reason why we work very closely with the Department of Budget Management and the Attorney General's Office on this, and the fact that the rest stops do serve the traveling public, the rest stops provide rest for individuals who are traveling.
Well, I understand all that, but why am I an emergency contract? Why was this not handled?
What we wanted to do is be able to provide those services in a quickly and timely fashion, and to make sure that there was no interruption in services out on the interstates. And so we felt that this was the appropriate mechanism to take, considering the fact that individuals could be at risk while driving, and we felt that...
How were they at risk?
Well, they could be tired. They could need to be pulled over, be able to get some type of coffee, Coke, Snickers bar, and so forth, just to be able to take that break and have an opportunity to kind of refreshen themselves before they continued on their drive. And so we felt that it was an emergency situation as a result of the traveling public. So.
Well, I'm not sure we agree. My first Board of Public Works meeting, we had an emergency procurement left over from the previous administration for public relations. It was a huge contract as an emergency, which we said we weren't going to do. There's a process of procurement that we like to follow. Certainly sometimes things come up as an emergency that we have to deal with, but we don't want to have the board wasting its time on things that are not emergencies. So, I don't know.
Yes, sir, I understand.
Let me ask a
technical question. There were six bidders when you brought this contract to us in 2017.
Yes, sir.
Why did you only directly solicit bids from three of the six original bidders?
In some cases, there's been consolidation within the industry, and so several of those companies no longer exist because they've been bought out by other companies. Actually, a couple of those companies that we solicited, Canteen and Accent, actually purchased several of those companies over the last couple of years. So we were looking for companies that had at least the capital to be able to move quickly in order to backfill from the previous contractor.
Okay. Well, I share the concern of the governor because classifying this as an emergency procurement is just, it's absurd at this state that, well, someone might need a cup of coffee to stay awake is pretty thin reasoning because under that reasoning, you could almost get rid of the procurement system and everybody could handpick their own vendors. So I share the governor's concern and I'm not quite sure what to do about it given that this is before us, but could you please...
So you were unable to go through a normal procurement because why?
Well, we felt, and after talking it over, again, with the Attorney General's office, that we felt that this was the best course of action.
The Attorney General's office thought that Snickers bars rose to an emergency?
Well, they felt that it it would...
I mean, I love Snickers as much as the next guy. But...
Yes, sir.
Not sure.
Yeah.
Well, they felt because of the public safety, because of the drivers, because there had been a lack of services being provided at the rest stops. That
and why is that? Why is there a lack of services? You terminated the contract. We didn't do another procurement for a new vendor. What exactly happened? Precipitate the lack of sodas?
Well, what happened was the vendor that had been previously awarded the contract was just not able to keep up with keeping the machines filled. The machines were constantly broken. They were constantly empty. We were receiving multiple complaints from the rest stops themselves indicating that they were receiving a lot of complaints from the traveling public who had stopped at the rest stops and gone to the vending machine.
And when did you award the contract to this failed vendor?
We awarded in 2017. And
then immediately you found out that they really weren't capable?
Well, we've been working with them since 2017. You know, we tried to do help remediate the situation, but they continued just to fail to perform at the level they needed to perform at. And so it was determined after approximately 18 months or so that we needed to make a change in who the contractor was.
And so after a long, normal procurement, you came up with a bad vendor, but now through an emergency, you think you're going to pick a good vendor?
Well, we think we've got a good vendor in there now. The machines are full throughout the industry.
And how is that person now operating?
I'm sorry, sir.
How is this vendor you have in there now able to operate?
Well, it's a large enough corporation that they...
I mean, how are they operating? Do you have a contract with them?
Yes, sir, we do.
And that's what you're coming before us retroactively to approve?
It was done under the emergency.
The emergency, Snickers.
Wasn't the emergency, excuse me, Governor, wasn't this emergency conducted, this procurement conducted just by email? Anybody ever sit down and talk to these people?
Well, we sent out inquiries to three companies to see whether or not they were interested in providing a service and doing the bid. And so...
And you got one response. And you believe that there are only three companies in Maryland that can fill vending machines?
Well, it's not that three companies can fill vending machines. It's whether they have the resources to move quickly on the on those sites and be able to continually keep those vending machines filled 7 days a week for around in difficult weather and so forth. And so We believe that the vendor that was selected is capable of doing that.
But are you paying them?
No, sir. This is a revenue-generating contract. This is money coming into the state.
So it's an emergency contract with no procurement process, with no competitive bids, and it's for 3 years.
And it's for profit.
And it's a profit-making thing for them. Does that mean so you just hand-picked them by sending them an email, but you're coming after the fact to ask us to approve it? Is that right?
Under the emergency procurement, yes, sir.
Is there any limit to the extent of an emergency contract?
Right, to clarify for everyone, this is because it's an emergency report, this contract has been awarded and is in effect. And what they are telling you, reporting in this item, is that it's a 3-year contract that they have awarded. So it is done. They're reporting it to you. But if they are...
it's not done if we don't...
Right, agree. No, I know. That's what I'm saying. But at this point, it is until you all do something, unless you all do something. What I'm saying is often emergency...
No, I'm not sure anyone should ever award a three-year contract as an emergency without approval.
And
I'm going to make a motion that we pull this item from the list.
Okay.
And vote on that second separately.
Because you did have your procurement advisor also advising you that he had felt there was enough time to conduct a standard procurement in the 2 months that was there.
Yeah.
And I think the competitive procurement had produced, I think, 6 bids, but the revenue rate they were promising back to the state was 51%. And this person is at 32%. So perhaps that 51% was too high for any company to be able to do.
Well, it's hard to figure that out when you don't have a bid.
Right. So this is a lot different rate from the rate that was approved 2 years ago.
We can either deny it right now or pull it out and do a vote.
We can defer that. We will defer this report.
I would move to just eliminate this proposal because it's not the specifics. I was mentioning the governor, I'd make a great cup of coffee, so I always want good coffee available, but this is something that serves as a bad precedent.
So what's the effect of doing that?
Okay. I think right now what you probably want to do is remand this, because that's really what you can do, accept the remand's report. As soon as you remand it, I am charging our procurement advisor to get with the agency and the attorney general to find out what can be done and report back to you based on this transcript discussion.
So the comptroller has a motion to remand. I second. All those in favor?
Aye.
3-0.
We'll get back to you,
this decision is remanded. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, could I just add, there are real emergencies.
Yes.
And to call things that don't on their surface appear to be anywhere near emergencies, an emergency tends to add.
I would never approve any contract as an emergency that lasts 3 years without a bid process for anything. So just the whole thing wasn't handled right. Thank you. Any other questions on the secretary?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0.
Thank you.
Let me just point out the PARS report, which is right at the beginning.
Number 3.
I don't have any problem with the PARS report, but I would point out that it includes a number of, as I understand it, task orders, just reporting, that are huge, that would never have been reported before until this board took the initiative to say they should be reported. These are very large expenditures. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with them, and they were done properly, but just to show what was going on.
For highlighting that, I'd forgotten, and thank you for the support, Madam Treasurer. I think it is an important change.
Mm-hmm. If we have it in the report, it makes it transparent because it's there and you have a report of it. But what you all did the last meeting and is now effective is these ones will actually have to come for approval. That was the comptroller's move. So this is just an interim thing of them reporting them to you. At the next meetings, it will be asking for your approval.
These are very large items.
Okay, thank you.
I have one other question. This really is a question on the wetlands licenses.
All right. Should we withdraw the unanimous approval?
We'll have discussion.
Is there a motion to reconsider?
Well, I'm not opposing it, but I do have a question, which is when, with the wetlands, when we set, people impact wetlands adversely, and they have to either mitigate it or pay a fee.
Okay, so
if they can't mitigate it, they pay a fee of a few hundred dollars.
Right.
How is that fee set?
Okay, we have Bill Morganti, our wetlands administrator here. Also, we have a representative from the Department of Environment. Currently, the mitigation is set at $75,000 an acre. If you are affecting a portion of an acreage, then you're going to multiply that by $75,000. And Mr. Morganti, you can explain mitigation a little bit further, but...
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Bill Morganti, Wells Administrator. You know, the way that the regulations are written, actually, if there needs to be mitigation, if there's impacts to wetlands and they're going to try to replace, or they need to mitigate it for somehow, then there's actually an order of what should be followed. And actually, first order is actually that they can replace it or can build something. But typically, with all of our projects that come before us, there is not the room on the site to actually do mitigation on the site, to actually create it on the site. So then the default, if they can't do that, is to pay into a compensation fund. So we've actually tried to search we've been using $75,000 an acre for decades, and we've actually tried to search like where that came from, and it appears that it's not in statute, it's not in reg, but it is policy that was established with MDB and I guess the board agreeing back in the 1990s. So the way it's...
It was a while ago.
I'm sorry, yes. And, you know, the way it's been calculated is based on the square footage of impact. You know, if it's 10,000 square feet, then it's $75,000 an acre that, you know, we just do a formula to then calculate what, out of the $75,000, how that would translate to $10,000 square foot of impact.
Have you all looked at this whole issue of wetlands mitigation, impact mitigation?
Yes, in terms of...
I don't know whether it's DNR or MDE or...
Yes, I mean, it's something that actually has been discussed many, many times between the board, between MDE, and, you know, the fact that it's a known fact that actually our use of $75,000 an acre is extremely low, because that really would have to do with acquiring the land, designing a wetland, building a wetland, and actually having monitoring for that after the wetland's built. That's a very low number, but we're working right now on redoing our regulations.
Well, that's only one piece. I mean, we are much more aware, I think, than we were 30 or 40 years ago of the importance of wetlands in mitigating the impact, among other things, of climate change. And what we want, I think, is to keep and enhance the wetlands, really, not just get money. So the question is whether these new sets of circumstances that we now understand about the role of wetlands is slightly different than it was 30 or 40 years ago. Our interests may be different, maybe more profound and acute. And I just wonder if we shouldn't be looking at that with somewhat fresh eyes. We want to enhance wetlands. I'm not saying that individual projects should be rejected at all, but our goal is to enhance the wetlands, I believe, and wetlands of a certain type too.
Yeah, I think a lot of that work is being done by MDE. Unfortunately, I don't think we have the MDE secretary or here with us that we can talk about.
But all I'm asking is if maybe you could talk among yourselves and come back to us and tell us what is needed to bring this whole process, including this fee, but that's a small part.
Right.
Certainly, yes.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to the DNR real property agenda.
Thank you. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. We have, for the record, Jeannie Hadaway-Riccio, Secretary of Department of Natural Resources. We have 7 items on our real property agenda today for which we are seeking approval, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions on DNR?
I had a little note. Hold up. I promised I would say something. DNR, item 4A, New Park. Senator Kagan thinks it's a great project.
Excellent. Can we send her a letter?
Yes.
Great project.
It is a very, very great project, and I think it's a perfect example of what program Open Space Local Side should be used for. And I think we have a representative from the city of Gaithersburg here today. So thank you for highlighting that project, Madam Treasurer.
Thank you for coming from Gaithersburg.
Is that where Judd Ashman comes from?
That is.
Yeah, give him my very best. There is someone who truly has an independent sense of integrity. Great mayor.
Second that. Is that a motion? A motion on DNR?
Move approval.
3-0. We move on to DBM.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer, David Brinkley, the Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. I brought 7 items on your agenda. I'm withdrawing item 7GM, leaving 6 for your consideration.
Any questions on DBM? Motion.
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Move on to the university system.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 3 items on the agenda. We'll answer any questions.
Mr. Comptroller. Yes. Seeing you standing here reminds me of the university system, and for some reason, the University of Maryland Medical System, UMS, the healthcare. I know it's not an academic institution, but just stay up there, Joe. Don't.
Yeah.
And I
poor
thought,
Joe, he's
yeah, I thought, I thought
not
frankly,
even part of the university system.
I almost was going to mention this, Governor, when we were talking about Harry Hughes, because he comes from the shore, and he was a great defender of the shore. And I recently spent some time with the leading citizens of Chestertown, and that was the head of Dixon Tools, a 400-person manufacturing company in Chestertown, and the head of Washington College. Fabulous school, and the head of a retirement community in Chestertown. And they had another dozen prominent members of the community. What were they meeting over? They were meeting over the fact that they believe UMS is going to close their local hospital that UMS bought several recently, I guess, a couple of years ago, and promised not to close. But now they feel the thing is being stripped down to its axles in preparation of being closed as a hospital and left as kind of a clinic, like other places that have been closed. So they desperately want their rural hospital to stay there for economic reasons and healthcare reasons and quality of life reasons. What do they think about when they read about the Board of Trustees at this $4 billion healthcare behemoth, largely funded by the taxpayers, where we have a among other things, and I won't list them, but the $500,000 book deal caught my eye with a former senator who led the finance committee that funded a lot of the operations of UMS. And obviously, everybody else is now wondering and wringing their hands about the self-dealing that was going on. Governor, I know you're meeting later on today with the leadership and with the speaker and the Senate president, and they're all upset. Well, the speaker's been on the board of directors for 16 years. 16 years. And when those people in Chestertown read about the number of contracts and other things, I can't imagine them doing anything other than being furious. And I hope out of the meeting will come an independent audit, not one done by the Legislative Audit Division, because that, everybody knows, it's under the thumb of the Speaker and the Senate President. So please, don't give us an audit by DLS. Give us an independent audit that asks who knew what when about this, well, the Speaker called it corruption
That was his word, not mine.
So please, out of this meeting, come up with a real examination of what happened here, because it goes back, obviously, a long time, and it raises some real ethical concerns. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry you were there.
Just to clarify.
I'll save him the trouble. I don't disagree with anything that the comptroller said. I just feel bad that it was directed at Mr. Evans. A lot of people are under the misunderstanding, I know the comptroller's not, that this is a state agency or that it is the university system, and it's not. It's a private, nonprofit organization, a separate board, and I agree, their state tax dollars go in there, and we are very concerned. It's outrageous and appalling, and that's why I demanded that people sever the relationships or get off the board. That's why I called them down here. They're coming to my office with the Speaker and the President later today, the entire leadership. But it's not really Mr. Evans or his responsibility, so I'm sorry you caught all the flack. But we had to direct it at somebody, right? I mean, I'm going to direct it to the leadership of the hospital and the chairman of the board and the top leadership over there, because it is something we need to get to the bottom of.
Governor, could I just say I agree with what you said and what you've done, and I think it ought to be a very productive and meaningful meeting, and changes have to be made. I would only disagree with the comptroller about the Office of Legislative Auditor. I think they are quite independent. They're not under anyone's thumb. I don't always agree with what they do or say, and share some of the comptroller's frustrations as the head of an agency that is audited by that group, and do think an outside look is appropriate, not necessarily the legislative auditor. But I wouldn't want anybody to think that the legislative audits are not strong, independent, usually accurate reflections of reality. This situation at University Hospital is
unfortunate.
Appalling.
Yeah. But I will comment, just since the treasurer brought up the audit of independence.
No, you did.
Years ago, years ago.
Comment on your comment, and I'm going to comment on your comment.
Years ago, the audit function was lodged in the comptroller's office. Really, a little known fact back in the 1960s. The auditor was appointed by the governor, but employed by the comptroller. And unfortunately, some of the audits of state agencies did not meet with the approval of individuals like Governor Taws and others. So they stripped the comptroller's office of the auditing function and moved it over to the legislature, where it currently resides. The treasurer has her opinion. I have my opinion about this group. But they then tried to strip Louis Goldstein of his office by having a constitutional amendment making his office appointed in 1968. And that was defeated. So I'm going into history here, but it, for some reason, if you don't say it, it repeats itself.
I wouldn't bring that up if I were you. There's 18 days left in the legislative session.
Yeah.
Could happen.
Yeah.
I mean, they're getting close.
Yeah.
Just welcome to my club.
They might do away with the governor and the comptroller.
Yeah. item three.
No comment from the treasurer.
Bowie parking lot?
Yes, ma'am.
It is my understanding that you all are coming back with a proposal for a solar canopy. Is that right?
I have Stephen Jaws, who is the director of procurement of Bowie State.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. No, actually, that's a separate contract that's already been approved. It doesn't
not
fall,
coming back.
No, it doesn't fall under construction, and it doesn't
but
fall
it
under
is,
services.
It is the same project. I mean, it's the same parking lot?
It's the same parking lot, separate projects.
Right. Well, I commend you for that. I think everywhere we're building these things, we should be looking at A, permeability, and B, the ability to use these facilities for energy production. Thank you.
Can you do permeability and solar panels
sure,
at the same time?
Sure, there's little holes between.
Between the solar panels, as the water goes through? No, just a question. I don't know. Any other questions on the university?
Thank you, sir.
Is there a...
Move approval.
Second. University, 3-0. IT.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I'm Michael Leahy, Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 7 items on the agenda. However, we are withdrawing item 7, IT mod. And I do have representatives from agencies here to answer any questions you may have.
Questions on information technology?
Just want to comment, Governor. Item 4 is about adding $300 million and 28 vendors to our existing consulting and technical services. Or CATS Plus master contract. This is a lot of money. It's always well managed by IT, but now they're going to have to, thanks to the board's action, bring any contract over $200,000 to the board. And I commend the agency and your administration and the treasurer for supporting that.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Controller.
You. Any other questions? Motion? Second? 3-0. Move on to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Pete Rom, Secretary of the Department of Transportation for the state of Maryland.
Mr. Secretary, we were talking earlier about Governor Hughes was the first transportation secretary. Which number are you, you know?
I don't actually know, but I did take the opportunity in Denton to have my photograph taken with Governor Hughes.
I'm the 62nd governor. I think we should find out what transportation secretary you are.
I'm about 74th since 1971. I'm not sure. Members of the board, I was going to share some positive information I just learned this morning, which is that my daughter will actually get her college degree, this spring, and that she will have accomplished that over just 3 terms. Bush, Obama, and
that's pretty good.
there was a day when she could see something yet.
Congratulate her for us.
Oh, yeah. We'll see if it works out. So, members of the board, the Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 16 items today, and either I or representatives of our various administrations are here to answer questions.
Questions on transportation.
Could I just ask a question on the paratransit proposal? It's a lot of money. And
yes.
It's kind of almost a Byzantine process where one of the bidders is peeled off and given or awarded, a separate contract. How did that all work?
So let's see. Kevin, would you come up to be able to go into the details there? I know paratransit is always a topic of conversation when it comes to the board because it is a great deal of money. It is something that we are required as a service to provide by federal law if we accept federal resources for transit. So with that, Kevin Quinn is our administrator.
From my perspective, not only because it's a lot of money, but it deals immediately with individual people who are in need and have concerns, and it sometimes are organized. So it's more than just money.
Well, it's an important service that we provide, but it's an expensive service as well, and it's growing.
How much money is this contract for?
We have 2 items here for paratransit. One is for our call center.
Why don't we let the administration address the issue?
Sure.
Good morning.
Morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Kevin Quinn. I'm the administrator of the Maryland Department of Transportation, Maryland Transit Administration. Here to speak with you about the mobility contracts. Just as some really quick background, Madam Treasurer, to your point, our mobility paratransit service is a specialized service for individuals who are unable to get to a bus stop or a bus station, unable to wait at a bus stop or a station or board a bus or a train. And folks use this service every day to get to school, to get to work, to doctor's appointments, things like that. It's available to folks under Americans with Disabilities Act within 3/4 of a mile of a bus route or a train stop. And annually, just to give you a sense of the scale here, we provide this service about 2.9 million riders per year. In fact, and to the Secretary's point of the growth that we've seen between 2010 and 2018, our ridership on paratransit has grown by 91%. It's tremendous growth. And just this past October, we set a record for the number of trips in a single month by 197,000 trips in the month of October alone. These are riders who in most cases just don't have access to any other form of transportation. We have to ensure that we're providing the best service that we can. And so given this growth, given the changes in technology that we see in the transportation field, changes in the industry and different business models that are quite frankly being tried, we're absolutely focused on taking innovative approaches to providing the service and contracting to get the best service, best value for our dollar, and our agenda items are reflective of that. I'm joined by Joe Sedtall, our Director of Procurement, and happy to answer any questions you may have.
So how does this work, since it's complicated? But it is two contracts, $685 million. You mentioned it was expensive, Mr. Secretary. And then a second contract of $60.2 million was given to one of the bidders, but this sole bidder, MV Transportation from Fairfield, California, is being awarded the $60.2 million second prize, I guess. How does that work? Do you just pluck them out of one bid and put them in another bid?
No, so the way the procurement was, sorry, for the record, my name is Joe Sedtall, Director of Procurement at M.MTA. The way the procurement was set up was to have two different functional areas, one for service and one for the control center, the MOCC, which you're referring to. One of the things that MTA wanted to do was ensure that there was no potential conflict of interest between the person and the vendor operating the control center and those providing service. The way the MTA is currently operating paratransit is we have three vendors who both provide service and dispatching in a call center. So, for example, MV would both operate their own call center and dispatch to their own service providers in the vehicles. The way we structured this procurement and these future contracts is to have a call center that is separate so that one entity can provide system-wide efficiencies for dispatching to two different providers. Now, the way the procurement actually played out was you could bid on both functional areas, but you could only be awarded one. Again, that's in reference to ensuring that there was no potential conflict of interest. So the way everything came about is one bidder did bid on the control center, and you received four bids on the service component.
Yeah, but why would they be connected? Because obviously the $685 million contract is more attractive than a $60.2 million. So why, under the what you just described, which is you can't do both, why would any of the three companies bid for the lower contract?
Well, the scenario, we saw one that did. MV did, in fact, submit
a proposal. Yeah, I know, but that just smacks of lack of competition, and particularly if it's a call center or dispatch center. And so it's obviously you've got a complex and costly package. I'm going to vote for it. I agree with the treasurer that it's always been problem ridden and expensive and difficult. But I just find this bid, as you just described it, to be unusual. And so maybe self-defeating as far as competition.
They're paid by the number of trips. Is that right? You said the conflict, if the people are dispatching, also are providing the service, then there might be a conflict because they're sending people to that.
So the idea would be exactly right, Governor. If you are both a service provider and the only call center, there, at least optically, could be the possibility that the control center would divert more of their dispatch rides to their service provider as opposed to one of the others.
This is actually to stop a conflict of interest and to stop them from making themselves more money.
How does that work?
Because a separate company has no incentive whatsoever to send it to those people.
As opposed to whom?
Is if you had the contract for both, you would just try to generate yourself more money.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I agree. I can see what you're saying, Governor, but I'm still confused about how you correct that with this entity.
Well, I think that's what they did.
Wouldn't there be a built-in conflict from the dispatcher saying, we're doing a great job, it's these bozos over here who are doing the operations that are messing up? I mean, if they ultimately would like to have the larger contract. Why wouldn't that be a...
Let me just take a shot at this real quick. So,
yeah, sure.
So if you're the operator of paratransit and you're being paid by the trip, you have an incentive to have as many trips as possible, right? So single ride trips, long mileage gets you more money, right? If you have a separate standalone dispatching center, they have the ability to combine trips. So it's not just a single person saying, oh, I'm going to come out here and bring this person here. That's dollars. The dispatcher, the now third party, is going to say, oh, you can pick someone up here and pick someone up here and pick someone up here to get full efficiency out of that trip.
And that can't be part of a procurement, that you require that and that they pay a bond and that they consider this and then they have a default path. I'm just suggesting that you've got something here that may not be as beneficial as you think. We'll stay in touch with it, I guess. But the proof here is whether customer service, and if what you're suggesting is, oh, we're going to do something efficient from your standpoint, which drives the public crazy if they're sitting there, not just one, two, three, four, but you're sending around buses now, picking people up, and it takes forever, that may be a... problem. So we'll, I guess if you can monitor the customer satisfaction in addition to the company satisfaction or whatever your satisfaction, I would be appreciative.
Thank you.
Do you still have an advisory board, paratransit customers?
We do. So we have two advisory boards, the Community Advisory Council and the Community Advisory Council with Individuals with Disabilities, so the CAC and the CACAT, and those are still active. I present to them both regularly.
And do they meet regularly?
Yeah.
Meaning how often do they meet?
They're monthly.
Okay.
Monthly.
Thank you.
And do you have periodic audit? I don't mean a financial audit, but you look at it to make sure the whole system is working the way it won't be like UMS board.
Uh-huh. Yes.
We do, and in fact, that's another procurement that we have associated with this in which it's quality assurance.
Yes.
And it's to have the whole gamut of testing of the quality of our service with mystery riders, testing the system, and it's a real step of improvement, I believe, and I believe the combination of features that we have here is going to give us efficiencies as well as improved service.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Secretary Ron, the quiz I gave you earlier that you failed miserably on, you guessed you were maybe 75th. The first 200 years, we didn't have any transportation secretaries. Harry Hughes was the first one in 1970 when he left the Senate, and you are only the 15th transportation secretary.
Wow.
Well, when we had dirt roads and horses and cobblestone, we didn't have any need for your position.
So, Governor, I'm very disappointed in my staff not having been able to present.
Oh, the staff. Hey, the buck stops at the secretary's desk.
Assistant secretary.
You know?
Yeah. I had some more items so I was going to bring up, but deference to the 15th transportation secretary, I'm going to defer.
Yeah.
Move
so,
approval.
Second. 3-0 on transportation. Last but not least, Secretary Churchill, we have the Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm the 11th Secretary.
Hey,
of
good job. Good job. Somebody did their homework.
Yes. Give them enough time. The department has 33 items on our agenda. We are withdrawing item 4 and 24, leaving 31 items left for your approval. We have agency representation to answer any questions you have at this time.
Did the former Secretary of DGS, the Lieutenant Governor, did he make you learn that?
Yes. Yeah, actually, on his picture, we have number 8.
Okay,
we have
number
big
eight.
Number 8
wow.
on it. Yeah.
That was a lot between, a couple of them came and gone.
Yeah.
All right.
I just have a question, not a problem. With 5A, the Lawyers Mall, how are we on schedule with everything that's happening out there?
No, I'm happy to report that Lawyers Mall, even though it may not look like there's constant activity, is on schedule. As a matter of fact, we were a little bit ahead of schedule as we came into the end of the year with the underground work. We're currently in our second phase, which is under design approval with the engineers. And so you'll be seeing activity coming up very soon.
I ask the same question every day as I walk past. Apparently, it's all happening underground.
It is your backyard.
Yeah, it's. But I think after the session, you'll see more on top of the ground, right? Because they were waiting not to disrupt with all the activity, but they're moving really ahead of schedule.
They are moving ahead of schedule. We have some more underground work to do with tie-ins of the buildings, and we're designing. We're in the process of moving forward with design concepts. Okay.
Very good. Is there questions on? Are there questions on DGS?
Not a question. Just to point out, Echo Hill, 18, yes. Great institution. Thank you very much for all you're doing with it. I think it's terrific. And Delegate Jacobs agrees. If you need help, back there, he's strong on it.
Good. Thank you. Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second? 3-0. Thank you. That concludes the Board of Public Works.